I will invite you to open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19. We've got quite a few family members from other places who are here visiting with us, and I know your families are happy to have you with them, and we're glad that you're able to worship with us this morning. You're an encouragement to us. I'm thankful for the privilege to stand before you and teach from God's Word. I hope that the things that we say are going to be helpful, clear, and understandable. And I would also just open the door for any questions or comments that you might have afterwards as well. We want to put all things to the test and hold fast to those things that are good and abstain from everything that is evil. We're going to be talking about a statement that is made by the disciples in a discussion about marriage and divorce. In verse 3, the Pharisees come to Jesus, testing him and asking him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all?" And he answered and said, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, 'For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh?' So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate." They said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away?" He said to them, "Because of the hardness of your hearts, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning it has not been this way. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another woman commits adultery." The disciples said to him, "If the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it is better not to marry." But he said to them, "Not all men can accept this statement, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who were born that way from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men, and there are also eunuchs who made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. He who is able to accept this, let him accept it." The statement, "it is better not to marry," that's somewhat startling to us. At least to me it seems. As much as I have enjoyed the companionship of my wife, as much as I have enjoyed the companionship of our children, for someone to hear Jesus talk about marriage and divorce and then say, "If this is really true, Jesus, wouldn't it be better not to marry at all?" And maybe, at least as I was reading it this time, I realized this, maybe I hadn't thought of it this way. This was probably the apostles. If you'll notice in verse 10, the disciples said to him, the disciples say this question. But then look in the same chapter, verse 25, the disciples hear what he says about the rich young ruler. And in verse 27, Peter says, "We have left everything and followed you." In verse 28, he says, "You shall sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." I know I kind of skimmed through that quickly, but disciples, Peter, 12. A lot of times the expression disciples is used generically to refer to the apostles in particular. The apostles were hearing what Jesus was saying, and it was difficult. And it was different than what they had heard. Do you think that maybe the apostles knew some people who were in difficult situations? Who knew some people, maybe as they were hearing what Jesus was saying, who would not be able to be married if they followed what Jesus was saying here? Marriage is a great blessing from God, but it must be taken very seriously, and it must be thought about and entered into with the most serious mind, because there are very high stakes. And so that's what I want to talk about this morning. And there are just kind of, I'm going to reduce it to four questions that I think are going to help us, you know, begin to think about how to be prepared for the blessings of marriage and the responsibilities. I want to begin with this question. Well, there I am. How often do I do that? I feel like once every other week I do that. I start at the end. The first question is this. Can I follow God's marriage laws? Can I follow what Jesus says here? Because Jesus teaches that divorce is sinful. A lot of times we talk about the exception in verse 9, and I believe we need to think about that and understand that. But the exception is not the rule. The rule is in verse 6 when he says, they are no longer two but one flesh. Since God has joined them together, Jesus says, do not let men separate that. To separate what God has joined is the epitome of presumption. To take something and God says it goes together, but I don't want it to go together. God has put it together, but I'm going to try to take it apart. That is the epitome of presumption. But yet, clearly, what did Jesus say? If we can't see maybe that kind of illustration, can we see this? Do not let man separate. That is a command saying, do not do this. The rule is that Jesus doesn't want us to divorce. Divorce is contrary to the will of Jesus and the will of the Father. And I would suggest this, that even as we consider the exception, that every divorce scenario will involve some kind of sin. If someone is putting away a mate for sexual immorality, well, the unfaithful mate bears the guilt of fornication. The generic word there, the broad word there, and I think the broad word there, you know, is there for a reason. That sexual acts fit into this category. It's not just adultery, heterosexual sex between two people and one is bound to another, or maybe both of them are married to other people. It would also be any kind of sexual act would be grounds for divorce, and the unfaithful mate is guilty of sexual immorality. But what about when a divorce occurs and there is no immorality? There is no sexual sin. Let me suggest to you that in that situation, both parties are bearing some guilt for violating the command of Jesus in verse 6. Now, in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul talks about someone being abandoned by a spouse. And I will say that in 1 Corinthians 7, that what Paul seems to be saying is that if someone abandons you, even though divorce is sinful, it's contrary to the will of God, if someone abandons you and you are trying to save the marriage and you're trying to keep the marriage from falling apart, but yet the spouse leaves you, that you bear no guilt for that divorce because you did everything that you could to try to save it. You'll notice what he says in verse 15. And specifically in this context, Paul is talking about someone abandoning their spouse because they're an unbeliever. You're a Christian and you're trying to serve the Lord, and they decide they don't want to serve the Lord, and they abandon you. If the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. And so in that situation, I don't want there to be any misunderstanding. One who is abandoned is not guilty for a divorce that occurs. But notice verse 11. If she does leave, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. You know, verse 10, Paul basically repeats what Jesus said about marriage. This is what the Lord says. The wife should not leave her husband. But if she does leave, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. So you may be abandoned, and you don't bear guilt for the divorce. But you can't marry another person because the divorce was not for sexual sin. Those are the conditions given by Jesus in Matthew 5:32 and Matthew 19 and verse 9. In Matthew 5:32, he talks specifically about the reason of immorality or unchastity. In Matthew 19 and verse 9, the idea, except for the reason or except for immorality or sexual immorality, that is the cause. And what is the significance of recognizing that? It means that the sexual sin must occur before the divorce. You see, if the sexual sin happens after the divorce, it can't be the cause for the divorce. And sometimes the argument is kind of made sometimes, and it's just not consistent with what Jesus teaches. Two people get divorced for no good reason, not for sexual immorality. They just decide we can't live together anymore. And then this partner, a few years later, they enter into a new relationship. And then this person says, oh, now I can be married again because they have committed sexual immorality. No, that doesn't fit with what Jesus teaches. Sexual sin must be the cause. And I have the word adultery here. It should be fornication. That the more generic word, a sexual sin, a sexual act, must be the cause if one is going to have a right to remarry. And I think this is also significant as well. If you turn back to Matthew 19, the idea of the innocent person initiating the divorce. Because if you look at what Jesus says, you have someone who divorces their spouse, and you have someone who is divorced. In the King James Version, you have the idea, you have someone who puts away their spouse, you have someone who is put away, you have someone who is divorced, and you have someone who does the divorcing. And I don't want to bind rules that God hasn't bound here. But if I am innocent and yet I do not initiate the divorce, then this is the way the divorce occurred. Someone put me away for no good reason. I didn't commit sexual sin, but someone put me away. I could wrongfully be put away, and according to this teaching, what would be my option? I would make myself a eunuch for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. In other words, I would refrain from marriage from that point forward for the sake of not violating what Jesus teaches about marriage, divorce, and remarriage here. And so that's me. And that's just a general understanding, a general thinking for all of us about what God says about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And I've got to think, can I follow that? Because what if I am abandoned by a spouse and now I'm in a position where I've got to become a eunuch for the kingdom of heaven's sake? Can I do that? Because if I can't do that and I find myself marrying again, and it's not for the divorce was not for sexual immorality, Jesus says in verse 9, if I marry another woman, I commit adultery. Those are the stakes, and they're very high, and I believe the apostles recognize that. The next question that would be very important would be, can the person that I am thinking about marrying, do I have confidence in them that they can follow God's laws? One question that I might think about with reference to my potential mate would be, are they eligible to be married? Do they have a right to be married? Let's think of everything that the scriptures say for just a moment. I think we can kind of break it down into four basic categories. These are the people who can be married. A person who has never been married. A person who, like Adam and Eve, you know, were leaving father and mother for the first time, and God was going to join them, and the two would become one flesh. Adam and Eve had never been married, and God brought them together and made them one flesh. That is the original example. And then in Romans chapter 7, you have the example of one who whose spouse was deceased. Now look, if you want to look in Romans 7, I feel confident that this is what is being said here. Although I will admit that this is an illustration that is setting up kind of the example or the idea of how we die to the law. Here's a law, and maybe this had a particular reference to the Jews, but the idea of dying to the law so that they could be joined to Christ. Dying to the old covenant so that they could participate in the new covenant. But notice how he establishes that in verse 3. So then if, while her husband is living, she is joined to another man, she shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from the law, so that she is not an adulteress, though she is joined to another man. Husband dies, the woman marries another man. That is lawful. Romans chapter 7 and verse 3. And then, of course, what we just talked about in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9, that one would divorce a spouse or put away a spouse because they had been sexually unfaithful. But then maybe one that we'll consider for just a moment here in 1 Corinthians 7 is that people who are reconciling have a right to be married. Now, I think I'm moving kind of quickly. I realize I'm taking for granted that probably we're familiar with a lot of this. But I do want to say it and put it out there in case someone has a question about it and we need to talk more about it. That's fine. So we've already kind of read this passage. So here's what the Lord said to the married. So there's several questions. The first question that Paul seems to be answering in 1 Corinthians 7 is, should we marry? And that is based on some type of persecution that is occurring in Corinth. And Paul refers to that in verse 26. I believe in verse 10, Paul begins to answer a second question. Well, should we divorce? Because our marriages are kind of, you know, there's the potential for strife, and there's a potential maybe that even that our mate, our children could be used against us. Maybe there's something along those lines. Should we divorce? Well, in verse 10, Paul says, what did the Lord say? The wife should not leave her husband. But what if she does leave? She must remain unmarried, or else she can be reconciled to her husband. And so one has the option to either remain unmarried once they realize that they have divorced and they don't have a right to remarry, or if circumstances allow, they can be reconciled to the person that they have an obligation, a right to be with. That's according to 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 and 11. And so I have to answer this question. To which category does my mate belong? The person that I'm thinking about marrying. What if the person that I'm thinking about marrying says that their spouse died? Well, in a lot of situations, that may be common knowledge to me. But what if it's not common knowledge? Because what happens a lot of times is that maybe we get older, and finding mates sometimes that those relationships are not as local as they might have been when we were younger. Maybe we met someone where we grew up. Maybe we met someone in college, and we knew a lot about that person. A lot of information was firsthand. But we meet someone who's 40, 50 years old, and maybe they live in another town. You know, this may seem like a thing that doesn't seem right or doesn't seem fair, but I need to be as sure as I can be. If I'm planning on marrying someone and they tell me that their spouse is deceased, and hopefully they realize that I'm trying to do the right thing, you know, and we're trying to do the right thing, this should not be a matter of trust or suspicion. I just need to know. I just need to have certainty. Someone says they are divorced for sexual sin. They say, I have a right to be married because I divorced my spouse for sexual sin. Well, in a lot of situations, maybe that's common knowledge. But what if it isn't? I need to be as sure as I can be about that. And I hate to have to tell you this. Maybe there are, you know, some young people here, and there's no telling what situation you may find yourself in. But there are Christians who have lied about their marital history. And it may not even be a matter of lying. Maybe they understand the passage differently than you understand it, and you don't have the same confidence that they have the right to be remarried. Find out as soon as you can. Know what you are getting into. Because go back to Matthew 19. I think what Jesus warns us about here is that we may be tempted to ignore God's law, especially if we get deeply emotionally involved with someone before we start asking these questions, before we start thinking about these things ourselves. And so the disciples say, well, if it's better, if it's like this with his wife, then it's better for a man not to marry. And Jesus doesn't back down. He doesn't say, oh, you misunderstood me. What he said was, not everyone can accept this. Not everyone can accept this teaching. Not everyone can accept the possible consequence of having to become a eunuch, to make yourself single for the kingdom of heaven's sake. Not everybody can accept that. And so if we get deeply emotionally involved before we begin to think about these things and ask these questions, we may become like one of those who see it, but we can't accept it, and we don't follow it. Because Jesus clearly says that in some cases, it may be necessary to forego marriage to enter into the kingdom of heaven. I have a friend, a dear friend that I love, that I miss. He's not faithful to the Lord anymore. And what happened was his wife eventually decided she didn't want to serve the Lord anymore. And she gave him an ultimatum. I want you to stop serving the Lord, at least in the way that you're serving him now. And we can stay together and we'll work on. He wasn't willing to do that initially. She divorced him. He knew that he had no right to remarry. He had no right to be married to anyone except her, and she was moving on with her life. And for a long time, he was faithful. For a long time, maybe even he was invigorated. He was teaching and he was preaching. He was taking on challenges that he hadn't taken on before. I think trying to maybe, you know, to motivate himself and to, you know, to use his time as a single person well. But he met someone. He was very young. He met someone that he liked. He met someone that was not going to live by what Jesus said here. And eventually they married and he became unfaithful to the Lord. And to me, it seems like it all started with his first wife leaving him, as well as things seemed to go at the beginning. You see, my mate, my choice in the mate is a serious choice. And, you know, you can do your best planning and have your best conversation and do everything that you can do, and you still can't control the way another person may eventually respond to the Word of God. If they abandon you, you can't abandon the Lord. And that's part of what you have to be thinking about. Well, the third question that we'll look at would be the idea of what God tells families. Because once we come together, we are a family. We have responsibilities as husbands and wives. We have responsibilities as parents if we have children. And so we can start with verse 5 here when God talks about a man leaving his father and mother and being joined to his wife. Can we leave our father and mother? Can we leave them behind? What does that mean? Obviously, it doesn't mean that we abandon them, because Jesus talks about adult parent or adult children, it seems, in Matthew 15, financially helping older parents who have fallen on hard times. They are adults, it seems. They are in a position to help in some way financially. And Jesus says, the command to honor your father and your mother applied to that situation. So it's not the idea that we're going to abandon our parents. But here's the thing. When we marry, we've started our own house. And sometimes, a lot of times, our house has to come first. But we can't let our parents tell us what to do. We can't let our parents come between us when we're trying to make decisions for our family. We have to make those decisions. And you know, the parents may be unwilling. They may be unwilling to step out of the way. But what about my mate? Does my mate appreciate and respect what God is showing us here? Because if my mate is going to, if we're going to be on the same page, look, our parents are not going to tell us what to do and you'll make decisions for us. We trust their wisdom. We love them. But they're not going to come in between us. If me and my mate are on the same page, we're going to be okay. But that is an important aspect of what God tells husbands and wives. Turn over to Ephesians chapter 5. I think this is, if you're a man considering marriage, it's very important for us to consider instructions like this, to consider the gravity of them. Okay, I want to get married. Maybe ask myself first this: I want to get married? Can I love my wife just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her? You see, we've got wives being told to be subject to their husbands in verse 22, in verse 23, verse 24. The church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be their husbands in everything. And then husbands are told to love their wives as Christ loved the church. What we learn from Jesus is that headship without sacrifice is not really love. Will I protect her purity? That was important to Jesus, to present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she would be holy and blameless. Well, what does that mean for me as a husband? It means I'm going to protect her purity. I'm going to be concerned about her sexual purity. I'm not going to be in any way, you know, forcing her, hey, you know, we're already engaged. Why don't we go ahead and indulge ourselves? What about her spiritual purity? I'm going to be concerned about her serving the Lord faithfully, and I'm going to do everything I can to help with that and not get in the way. Will I love her as I love myself? Husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. And the idea of, you'll notice in verse, no one ever hated his own flesh. He nourishes it. He cherishes it. I think Philippians 2 in verse 3 suggests to us that loving someone the way we love ourselves actually means putting them above ourselves sometimes. Sometimes I do for my wife what she needs. I may not need it. I may not be interested in it, but she needs it. And I do it because I love her as Christ loved the church. Will I provide for her needs? In 1 Timothy 5 in verse 8, that is a responsibility, young men, that we need to be prepared for. Husbands, to be willing to take on the role of provider. If anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Paul here is talking about widows in the family. But doesn't that include wives and children? That we would be providing for our own. That we would be preparing for the relationship in that way. There may be times when I am solely responsible for what's coming into the family. There may be a lot of times like that. Questions that women need to ask themselves, going back to Ephesians 5. Can I be subject to this man? Can I follow him? Can I follow him as I follow Christ? In the example of Christ, there may be times when we don't understand specifically why Jesus has said to do something a certain way. But we know what he's telling us to do. Well, what do? We do what he says, even if we don't understand it. When it comes to our husbands sometimes, maybe we don't understand their reasoning for something. Or maybe we don't necessarily even agree. But will I be subject to him as I am to the Lord? And let me just say that sacrifice and submission, they're really, in the marriage relationship, they're reciprocal. Sacrifice and submission are reciprocal. They tend to produce the other. One produces the other. Sacrifice in the husband produces submission in the wife, and submission in the wife produces a greater willingness to sacrifice on the part of the husband. And the absence of one stifles the other. If submission is absent, there's a good chance that sacrifice may be absent, or at least lacking. And if sacrifice is absent, submission is going to be lacking. And so, you know, think about this man. Can I trust him to lead me spiritually? That's an important question to ask. Am I willing to be faithful to the Lord even if my husband is not? And what will be some of the consequences that I may face if my husband is not faithful to the Lord? Are there any risks that I might be taking? Are there any warning signs in the man that I'm considering? Now, we've already said, you can do all your research and maybe you feel like you've had all the talks, but eventually, maybe someone makes a bad choice. And we can't control that. This is an important one to consider. If we have children, will we teach them to serve the Lord? Will we require them to be accountable for their actions? Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Fathers, don't provoke your children to anger. Bring them up in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord. There is a responsibility for fathers, but you've noticed this passage is about parents. It's not like, you know, that husbands and wives, mothers and fathers, have to be on the same page. That teaching them to love the Lord is the most important thing that we can do, the most important thing that we can give them. Children are a gift. They're a blessing. They change our lives. My children have changed my life. And maybe that's been a slow, maybe they would say it's been a slow process. But they've changed my life. They've changed what I want in life. They've changed who I want to be. That's awesome. But I've got to be consistent in trying to train them and holding them accountable and holding myself accountable so that they can see us trying to consistently submit to the Lord. What's most important to us? That we all get to heaven, that the Lord be glorified in us. And you know, that, you know, by implication, the parents are thinking about the needs of the children together. Suppose the man becomes disabled. Somebody's still got to work, and these children still have needs, and the family still has needs. And sometimes the family finds itself in a different situation, but both parents are thinking, now we've brought these children into the world, and we are going to raise them and make sure that they are taken care of. But maybe even more important than that is the need for us to be willing to sacrifice together to put their needs ahead of what we may want. You know, in 1 Timothy 5 and Titus chapter 2, both talk about the idea, you know, in 1 Timothy 5, he's talking about younger widows marrying, bearing children, and managing the house. In Titus 2, Paul is talking about women loving their husbands, loving their children, being workers at home. I think what's being communicated there is the need for the family to be willing to put the children first. That sometimes our plans as a husband and wife may be put on a back burner because the children have certain needs for a certain time, and we're going to put them first for that period of time. These are all kinds of responsibilities that we have to think about. It's an important question to consider, to talk about with the person that you might be considering marrying. The last thing that I want to talk about here is just the idea of commitment in general. This could apply to every relationship in our lives. It is, you know, there are people that we come in contact with, and even people that we have responsibilities to, that drain us. They take much more than they give. And I want us to understand that, you know, particularly in a husband and wife relationship, that doesn't excuse us from any of our responsibilities. And maybe it would be true for all those other relationships. You know, sometimes people are just disruptive. But what we should all be striving for is the kind of commitment that Ruth expresses here. And I realize she's talking to Naomi, her mother-in-law. But the kind of commitment, this is the kind of commitment that will make any relationship better. Naomi's getting ready to go back to Bethlehem. And Ruth is from Moab, and Orpah's from Moab. And Naomi tells them, go back home to your families and your parents. And Orpah eventually does go back. But Ruth says in verse 16, do not urge me to leave you or to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried, and the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. This is the kind of commitment that we need to have. You know, sometimes two people are trying to make one life, and sometimes that requires me to sacrifice. We've already talked about that. Maybe I'd rather not live in this place, but right now, it's the best place for my mate. It's maybe the best place for work situation. Maybe a lot of times we don't make this consideration. It's the best place for us and our children spiritually. And so we're going to stay here. Maybe it's not where we want to live right now, but it's the best place. And so we make a sacrifice, a choice to put the other first, hopefully to put the Lord first. Wherever you live, it doesn't matter. Wherever you go, Naomi, I'm going to go with you. Wherever you live, Naomi, I'm going to live with you. Oh, well, I'm going back to my people. Well, your people can be my people. That's fine. Ruth makes a vow. It seems to me that she's making a vow there when she says, may the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. I think that goes along well with the idea of marriage being a covenant. Marriage is a covenant between two people. And apparently God has joined together. What God has joined together, let not man separate. And so not only is a casual or a flippant attitude toward marriage, not only is that really a disregard for the other person, they deserve more than that, but a casual or a flippant attitude toward marriage is a disregard for God. If we cannot commit the way Ruth describes, it would be better for us not to marry. Let's talk just briefly for a moment about some wrong reasons for marriage. There are a lot of ideas out there, pressures in the culture. Sometimes people are attracted to one another. And maybe they're thinking, well, we don't want to violate God's laws. We're attracted to one another. Let's get married. If sexual desire is the basis and the foundation of your marriage, that's not a good foundation. Because I know someone who had a marriage and person became unable to be sexually involved. You know what happened? The marriage ended. This is supposed to be a Christian. But see, when sexual desire is the foundation of your marriage, you don't have a good foundation. You need all those other things. Commitment to God, commitment to one another, willing to sacrifice. I would suggest to you that pregnancy is not even a reason to get married. If pregnancy is the foundation of your marriage, that's the wrong foundation. Now, a lot of times, you know, young Christians might make a mistake and they think that they can, you know, well, you know, this child deserves to be loved. This child deserves to be taken care of. And, you know, we've done this now. If you go through that process and you have that conversation and you recognize that the foundation of the marriage is commitment to God and not because we got pregnant, then that's okay. But just to base a marriage on a pregnancy, that wouldn't be good. Don't compound the problem. Sometimes people are thinking about perhaps, well, we could have a better lifestyle if we got married. Maybe we could have get some tax breaks. That'd be nice. Well, we really like hanging out, you know. Maybe we could just live together and some people have roommates and we'll just live together and we'll be roommates with benefits. And I would say that maybe even the idea of being in love is not necessarily a reason to decide to get married. Because we already talked about people who are not willing to accept what Jesus said in Matthew 19 and verse 11. Once we get emotionally involved, we may decide to ignore what God has said. So yes, love, a feel warmly affectionate toward my mate, yes. But my marriage needs to be founded on biblical principles, commitment to God, willingness to sacrifice. And the idea of other people getting married, I think sometimes maybe young people feel pressured. Other people are getting married. When are you going to find someone to get married to? Well, that's not a reason to start looking for someone to get married. Start with the biblical foundation. Marriage is a wonderful blessing from God. God intended it to be a blessing. He made us male and female. He anticipated that we would desire companionship. And the fact of the matter is that most people will marry. But it does need to be considered seriously. What Jesus says should enter into our thinking, and we should realize that there is a commitment being made and there is somewhat of a risk being taken. I'm willing to take that risk. And no matter what happens, I'm going to remain faithful to the Lord. So what are we talking about this morning? We're talking a lot about marriage and divorce, and you might say, well, when are we going to start talking about Jesus? Everything that we have said is out of a desire to please Jesus and to do what Jesus has told us he expects and what he tells us is best for us. We believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And if you're here this morning and you believe that he's the Son of God, we invite you, we urge you, we encourage you to respond to the Lord's invitation. We're going to sing a song. We hope that you'll come.